Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Klink.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Scott Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's a Need to Know podcast. All thanks to the CIA Ops patron community. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, N2K Podcast, and online at ciaops.podbean.com.
Thank you for joining me for the Need to Know podcast. This is episode 274, and my name is Robert Crane. Now, the news from Microsoft is that the basic authentication in Exchange Online will be disabled across all tenants beginning on the 1st of October 2022. So what this is that basic authentication is the support for older protocols such as POP, IMAP, to allow connection to mailboxes. Now the problem with these is that the older legacy or basic authentication does not support things like MFA, does not support things like conditional access. So this allows attackers to launch brute force or password spray attacks against a mailbox and effectively try and guess the password, and they generally are very successful because they can continue to throw these sort of attacks constantly at environments to get in. Now, the idea here is there is very little need this day and age for basic authentication. So Microsoft has looked at its metrics, looked at the tenants out there, and basically is letting you know that after the 1st of October 2022, the basic auth will be disabled. Now, in many cases, if you spin up a new tenant, things like SKU defaults will block legacy auth, but best practice is always to go in and turn those off totally inside the tenant, not just have them blocked by something like conditional access. So if you haven't had a look at the fact whether basic auth is enabled on your tenant, go into your Azure AD logs. You can then filter them down and see which legacy authentication protocols are still in play, and then you can take action to remove them or limit those, eliminate those from your environment. But be warned that coming shortly, Microsoft will be basically disabling legacy auth across all tenants. And I'll put the link in the show notes here so you can go in and read more about what Microsoft has to say about that. Now, Microsoft has also let us know there are now new minimum requirements for Outlook with Microsoft 365. So what's going to happen is that older versions, so basically what they're saying is that after the 1st of November 2021, only Outlook 2013 Service Pack 1 and better will be able to connect to Microsoft 365 mailboxes, and anything else will actually be blocked. So again, the idea is if you are staying current, if you are staying up to date, then this should be no worry for you. It's only if you do have those older versions of Outlook. And again, best practice is generally to make sure you're up to date with the latest version. Most tenants will include a version of Outlook or the latest version of Outlook as part of their tenant, so it makes sense to make sure that you're up to date and you stay up to date. So if you are running older versions, again, go in and have a look at this article and look at the advice Microsoft's providing around this fact that it will be limiting which versions of Outlook can connect to Microsoft 365 shortly. Now, Microsoft has had a number of security challenges of late. It has detailed some of these in some articles I've got for you to go in and have a look at. Now, the first one here is about analyzing attacks that exploit the CVE-2021-40444, the MSHTML vulnerability. Lots of really good detail in here about what happened, what's involved, how it works, what to watch out for, how to mitigate this. So again, commend you to go in and have a look at this, read this in detail, and make sure that your environment remains secure and you do what needs to be done to mitigate these threats. Now, on the security front, another great blog article by Microsoft is a deep dive into the SolarWinds SSH vulnerability. Again, lots of really good detail in there if you're on the security side and want to understand what was involved with that SolarWinds attacks and what Microsoft found in its own environment, and again, how to go and mitigate those as well. So I commend you to read both of those articles in detail. Make sure that they are in the show notes for you. Now, another one to mention is a recent vulnerability in the OMI software that Microsoft rolls out typically to Unix machines. So if you do run Linux in Azure especially, make sure that you go and have a look at the information Microsoft is providing, what needs to be done in your case. Now, another really good thing here is that Microsoft has given us the ability to hunt for this vulnerability using Azure Sentinel. So big fan of Azure Sentinel, and it does provide a way for you to go and look at this using your Azure Sentinel to determine whether you have any machines that are vulnerable or that would need to be fixed and updated. So again, I'll put the link in the show notes so you can go in and have a look at that, get some more information about the OMI vulnerability, but that is largely affecting Linux machines in Azure. Now, another big announcement Microsoft had was a whole range of new Surface products. These are aimed typically with Windows 11, which is also coming out very shortly, October the 5th for Windows 11. We've got sort of, a new Surface Studio laptop, which is sort of like a yoga where the screen can fold through a number of different ways. It's interesting how Microsoft portrays this as for creators, so you can use it, just as the screen, you can use it as a tablet. It is a quite powerful machine. So again, go and have a look at that. It's very interesting, some of the engineering they've done with that. The other one which has got me excited is the new Surface Pro 8. This seems to be a major step up from the Surface Pro 7, so I'll certainly be considering that when it does become available, probably towards the new year here in Australia. Now, the other one that really grabbed my attention is the new Surface Duo 2. Luckily, or interestingly, this product will be shipping to Australia. It's listed in the Windows Store here in Australia. So it's going to be an expensive option, and we don't expect to see that here till well into 2022. This device is a combination of a PDA-style tablet and phone together with a hinge in the middle. Again, it's not designed to replace an individual handset like an iPhone, which again are also coming out with new versions, or Pixels and so on. I think it's interesting that it's going to have this side-by-side capability. Think of it as a very small laptop that you could carry around with you much more conveniently, take notes on one side, read your emails on the other. Again, very interested to see how that works and how that operates, and we'll certainly be taking a look at it when it becomes available here in Australia, which certainly seems to be the case. So again, I'll put a link in the show notes for you to go and have a look at this range of Surface machines. They seem to be getting good reviews at this stage, so again, encourage you to go and have a look basically at those. Now, Microsoft has also announced that Viva Connections is in public preview. This is the capability, effectively, I suppose, to have a quicker insight or a quicker access to your intranet. Think of Viva as sitting above Microsoft Teams. We're moving to a world where structure is largely becoming irrelevant. The information that users need is going to be surfaced to them via the software, via the AI and the algorithm in the background, and Viva Connections is a way to view all that. So it's a fairly simple and straightforward process you need to go and enable this for your organization. So again, follow the links I'll put in the notes there for you to go and enable it for your environment. I've done it in my environment. A couple of things needed to be turned on around navigation and so on, but once that's on, fairly straightforward to set up and start using, and then get the feel of Viva as it's coming out, as it's beginning to roll out more and more. Now, one of the other big things Microsoft has pushed, especially to consumers, is this concept of passwordless. So what you can do now with your Microsoft consumer accounts is you can actually set up the environment so it's totally passwordless, so that if you log into outlook.com to read your mail there, then rather than putting a password in, it will prompt you on your Microsoft Authenticator app. You verify that and you log in with, again, without putting in a password. And you can actually go in and remove the password from the account. So very, very interesting, that approach. That is going to really encourage people. You know, is it really a good idea to remove the password totally? Is a lot of people going to do that? I think they will as they become more comfortable with it. Passwords have been with us for a very long time. Throwing them away or deleting them is something that probably a lot of people are very reticent to do straight out of the box, but the option is there. Again, go and read the article to have a look at that. Now, we've been able to do something very similar with the commercial accounts using passwordless. So we've got Windows Hello for Business, we've got YubiKeys, we've got push authentication and via the mobile app. So that has been possible for a while. The difference that I see here is mainly around Microsoft's push to actually go in and delete or remove the password from the account. So again, very interesting to see how many people take that up. But if you have an account, I reckon it's a good option. So go in there, have a look at the information, and as Microsoft would encourage you, go passwordless. Now, we've also got general availability of the capability for Azure VMs to Azure VMs that are in Azure Virtual Desktop to be directly Azure AD joined. So a lot of Azures there. So when you spin up a Azure Virtual Desktop environment, so think of this as a VDI Virtual Desktop environment, one of the challenges has been, how does it get its identity? Traditionally, the requirement has been for some sort of directory service, that being, you know, a local Active Directory rather than Azure AD. So many machines, many of these environments couldn't draw in directly to Azure AD, but now Microsoft has announced the general availability of this. So if you are looking at using Azure Virtual Desktop, you can now eliminate the need to have a separate domain controller and connect these directly in to your environment and have people working on them. Now, remember that Azure Virtual Desktop is one of the VDI solutions Microsoft has out there. The other one is the Windows 365. So Windows 365 comes in two flavors, the business and the enterprise, and then we also have the Azure Virtual Desktop. The major difference is that Azure Virtual Desktop gives you the most flexibility and the billing is done on a consumption basis. So this means that you only pay for exactly what you use, whereas Windows 365 is a flat fee per month for the machine. So the major difference is around the billing and also the flexibility when setting up configuration options. And like I said, Azure Virtual Desktop now supports direct Azure joined VMs, which is fantastic news. Now, the last bit of news I've got here for you, and again, the links will be in the notes for you, is if you are looking at your Microsoft Teams desktop or web client and you see a little P, the letter P next to your avatar or next to your name icon there, what is just letting you know is that you are part of the preview policy. So it's got basically a preview to show you some of the newer features. Now, you can opt in, you can opt out, you can control that. But generally, most people who are on early release with Windows 365 will have this capability. And again, if you do see a P in your icon in Teams, don't fret. Basically, you are in this public preview area for Microsoft to test new features. So again, I'll put the link in the show notes so you can go in and have a look at that, get some more information about what's going on there. So as always, you can contact me directly via email, director@ciaops.com. You can also follow me on the Twitters @directorcia. And of course, always looking for some feedback or suggestions around who you'd like to see on this podcast. And also, if you would like to appear on the podcast yourself, please don't hesitate to drop me a note. There's always Some great conversations had with people out there around the Microsoft 365 and Azure and the cloud space in general. So if you are interested, please, by all means, reach out. Let me know. We can arrange to do an interview and then push it out to provide benefit to all our listeners. So once again, thank you very much for listening to this episode, and let's get into the interview. Welcome along to our interview for this episode. I'm George, joined by George Farah from Ingram Micro. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Robert.
He's apparently a long-time listener, first-time contributor. Is that correct?
That's probably correct, yes.
So with that in mind, it's probably a good idea to introduce yourself to the audience. Just let us know who you are and what you're currently doing at this point in time.
Yeah, my name is George Farah. I work for Ingram Micro. I am the business development manager for the Microsoft Modern Workplace practice.
Cool. Now, one of the interesting things, George and I have known each other for a while. George has come from, a background that has moved along with the technology, with the times, and with the cloud. And what we thought we'd do to kick this off is maybe go on a bit of an adventure in the Wayback Machine and just have a look at some of the changes that have taken place, probably more from a, distributor's side of the fence, and then how that has played out into the economics for partners. So why don't you give us a bit of a grounding, George, on, where you would see this journey sort of starting that we can now say has accumulated in, the Microsoft 365 space?
Yeah, well, it's, I sort of date it back to 2003 when I joined Trend Micro. And Trend Micro, being a security vendor at the time, had innovated particularly in the sort of network space with on-the-fly scanning. So going back to sort of those early
What sort of date was that? Just to give us a bit of context. What sort
2003.
Right, yep.
At the time, I was working with predominantly service providers. And we had a team in the UK who were building, you probably remember the acronym ASP, Application mm-hmm. Service Provision.
Yep.
So we were looking at ways where we could transform the business, at least for that service provider segment, to provide was the early version of SaaS. So a monthly cost per user there were a number of different pricing models, and we worked on things like doing pricing based on bandwidth or based on CPU and on obviously on seat count. So those were kind of the early days of what we now know as SaaS. And I think at the time I remember engaging with Phil Meyer at Microsoft, who was running the hosting business at the time at Microsoft. And I remember engaging NewLease at the time, who was this new distribution business that was focused on this sort of, per user or a monthly cost for software and applications.
Would it be fair to say that back at that point in time, what was the general feeling? I mean, we could see the potential of the cloud, but there was, resistance points around bandwidth and, changing a business model. Did you see those sort of benefits or where it was going to go down the track? And also, did you also find that there was resistance even inside, that organization to actually move in this direction? What was the sort of feeling from inside, trying to address this coming change in technology?
Well, yeah, there was absolutely resistance within the business itself. Trend Trend was an organization run by sort of a charismatic business leader who always looked to the future. And we also had, other terminology began being used internally called, utility computing was what we were also being referred to. So we were allowed to sort of experiment a little bit. But there was definitely resistance internally because, traditionally you sold software, fairly large upfront cost in the first year, and then then you went to a sort of a maintenance, you know, sort of 25% of the initial cost you would then pay in maintenance annually. And you'd normally sign a client up for 3 years, so you knew you had some revenue locked in. The idea of the ASP model, or later became SaaS, was that you were moving to a monthly subscription. You know, billing systems couldn't handle that for a lot of software vendors. So this was really an experiment. And so you had resistance internally, so within the business, and you had some resistance, obviously, with some service providers who were sort of addicted to that upfront payment for software subscriptions, and they didn't really want to move away from that. And it was going to be hard to transition away from that, particularly when billing systems are set up the way they are.
Yeah, I was going to say billing systems would be one of the, you know, major challenges, because typically it's a, you know, once-off transaction. You do it, then pay the money, and then it's out the door, and that's then invoiced and closed off. And to have this recurring model, and I think anybody who does have or has been involved in a recurring model, you get a lot more challenges around the account management. You know, people forget their credit card gets stolen, they need to, you know, put it in. There is generally a lot more account management that needs to be, and a lot of it can be automated away, but I can see that people, you know, just want to be done with this, close this off, you know, close the invoice and we're done, move forward sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, telcos had already been doing this. You know, they were already charging, you know, they had a monthly billing system in place. So it wasn't going to be that big a challenge. But if you had built your business on selling a large amount of software up front and then getting some recurring revenue in maintenance to try and shift that, because the early commercial models were we would take a 3-year subscription and then divide it by 36, and then that would be the monthly cost. So the inhibitors were the fact that, you know, most people weren't set up to do that, and of course there was a change in, you know, this capital expense and then an ongoing expense. People weren't really prepared to make that change, even though I think customers were probably requesting it. And as you go through the years and see why Microsoft made that change, a lot of the early discussions that Microsoft had with customers were, how do I move away from this really cumbersome model that could be more flexible?
I think you're right. I think the leader, when you step back and look at this in the bigger scheme, was definitely the telcos, because with the advent of the mobile, they moved to the option of, you know, firstly paying per month for the usage, and then they rolled the phone costs into that so people could then upgrade their devices and get newer devices much faster. Then they basically, you know, started to move to a model where you get as much talk and text as you want, but then you started paying for data. And we see with the new version of the iPhone coming out, you know, I'm getting bombarded with emails about, you know, it's time to, you know, upgrade, do this, you'll get extra amount of gigs of data. Mm. But at its core, you're right, they were the ones that really pioneered this. And it's obviously been very successful for them, because they have transitioned from that model. And back in the day, you can remember, you know, there were lots and lots of people who sold phones as a third-party vendor and got these trailing commissions. So it obviously was a very successful business model.
It worked very well. And I think in those early days, it was that billing model that we had built for at Trend was primarily, it was targeted at the telcos. We would sell our software to the telcos and charge them, you know, sign them to a 3-year contract, and then they had a monthly subscription they could pay, or they could pay annually if that's how that worked for them. But that idea that they could provide a service to their customers and add a little bit more onto the internet subscription cost or on the data network charge and just add security to that was kind of the genesis of how we eventually moved. Because you couldn't get many service providers, many MSPs to do that, even though there were a number who were considering it and wanted to adopt it. It was still very early days.
So when you, obviously you were, you know, involved with a business that was moving this way and wanting to move this way, you were talking to people like Microsoft that were, you know, bringing this to the table. As an observer of the industry, you know, the provider industry moving in this direction. You know, could you see that sort of coming as more businesses, oh, if they're doing it, we need to do it, and Microsoft's doing it, so we need to do it. You know, was that the sort of thing, this sort of realization that this is going to be the common way, and we need to get on board and come up with some sort of plan to be able to accommodate this?
I don't think it was that evident then, even though the discussion around utility compute was starting to gather pace, particularly around 2006, 2007. We were beginning to think that way as well, a trend. But you didn't see the industry move that way rapidly. I think the real catalyst was when Microsoft launched BPOS late in that decade. And because you generally need a large vendor to make a substantial change. Before that, it was piecemeal, and it was limited to, you know, sort of early adopters who thought this was a good idea. But you didn't really see it until sort of Microsoft kicked off with BPOS.
And it was interesting that, as many people locally are aware, maybe not overseas listeners, but in Australia, Microsoft went through a sole distributor, being the largest telco we have here in Australia, and that was the original way to get BPOS, or the precursor to Microsoft or Office 365. And that, you would have to agree, I think, George, caused a major kerfuffle in the market, didn't it?
Oh, well, kerfuffle is probably an understatement. I think it drove a lot of traditional Microsoft partners quite crazy that Microsoft was launching a new service offering. And they were basically excluding, or, you know, doing an exclusive deal with Telstra, and it was a 5-year deal too. So it wasn't going to be sort of a 1 or 2 year thing. It was really a trial that Microsoft thought that here is a small country that we could almost do a test in, and on a global level, it wasn't going to be a significant hit to its business. But it was a real trial to see whether a telco could really drive this sort of product. It did cause a lot of problems for Microsoft locally, I'm sure.
The main thing is that Microsoft, you know, back then had a partner program, and it had provided its products, typically software, via a distributor network. People like Ingram and the resellers would buy it from that, then go on and provide it to their customers. Now you had basically a telco who was obviously looking probably more at the commodity side of it, you know, big volumes to get it out there. And they already had a partner network in place with their business centers who were selling mobiles and plans. And if you step back and look at it, it sort of makes sense that, okay, well, you know, that telco was the largest internet provider, the largest mobile provider in the country, so why not? It made sense to tee these up. But I think it's very interesting that, to me, looking back on it, that it all seems well and good at the boardroom, but at the coalface, it was like, well, the telco people didn't know enough about IT, and the IT people, this was a big change to a telco model, and it really didn't suit anybody, and everybody sort of felt out in the cold. So I think that did sort of delay the uptake here quite significantly with that model, which again did get rectified, but it did take a little while, and that did leave, you know, a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths that it went in that direction compared to what happened overseas.
Yeah, because you'd always look back and think, well, had Microsoft made the product available to its channel, whether we would be so much further down the track. So it's hard to say now whether that would have been the case, but you'd think that, you know, there would be a much deeper penetration of 365 in the business community in particular, had Microsoft made that available to everybody. But what it did do is introduce completely new channel to Microsoft, but also a new channel for Telstra. So Telstra was acquiring MSPs who wanted to move down this path, but it was also introducing Microsoft 365, or back then BPOS, to its channel and some of its partners who were looking to move up the stack from selling sort of telco to sort of, you know, selling a more integrated solution to their customers.
Yeah, and I think that was sort of another interesting dynamic, because you had largely a separation of, you know, traditional telco, PBX, phone people, that then you had the, you know, traditional SMB, IT, reseller provided servers, workstations and support. And now we're beginning to see this blending. Now, also in all of this, I think another thing that is perhaps slightly overlooked in all of this is the fact that both Microsoft and Telstra, the telco, themselves were offering this product directly on a website. So you had effectively four people now, or four different demographics in the market, that a customer could purchase effectively the same product at effectively the same cost, you know, if we're just looking at the product. And I think that caused, you know, angst with people, because, you know, some people's business model had always been about, you know, buying a toner cartridge, adding a margin and reselling it as a consumable. And now, like I said, the SaaS market came along and it was a very big change to the economics of many people who are used to dealing with that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in 2008, Telstra launched the T-Suite portal, which is now the Telstra Cloud Marketplace. And T-Suite was a range of software as a service subscriptions. Obviously, the predominant one was Microsoft BPOS, later to become 365. And when they launched it, there was a bit of a delay in some uptake, so they began to recruit a number of specialists to help enable the sales teams to go out and sell it, particularly to small and medium business customers. So at that time, I actually joined Telstra as one of these T-Suite specialists, or later became a cloud specialist. So at that stage, Microsoft had the portal. It had us, you know, a couple of specialists in each state going out with the Telstra sales team. At the same time, we built a channel program specifically for this T-Suite offering. And then within a couple of years, we had a private cloud offering, and then we merged these two sales teams together so that we had both an IaaS and a SaaS capability within the sales force. Then we transitioned to Office 365, and of course things took off. And we try a whole bunch of things, like sort of bundling Exchange Online with internet services. Again, it was very difficult to get customers in the first couple of years to make the transition. But once, I think at the time we also had an issue with the Australian dollar, was actually more valuable than the US dollar. So we were seeing customers buying BPOS and 365 out of the US because they were getting it at a cheaper rate. But over time, as our currency changed, things began to move, and we began to see a shift as we, you know, you'd, like with anything, you get a bit of momentum going, and suddenly customers realized this was a really good way to acquire Microsoft services, particularly Exchange. That kind of led the charge, that suddenly they could move their Exchange service out of their own environment and into a Microsoft environment. And the argument always was, well, who's better to manage your Exchange? Is it you or your IT guy, or is it Microsoft? And once that message sort of cut through, as bandwidth became more cost effective and more efficient, it made it, so you sort of in that early part of, you know, 2011, 2012, we really began to see a significant uptake. Now, we had probably focused too much on the Exchange bit, so it was a very much an infrastructure play. But then over time, we had Link and then Skype, and now, of course, it's Teams. Those products came to the fore, but we almost had to establish a beachhead with clients to say, look, move to the cloud with your Exchange, get that out of the office and have it backed up and have it, you know, always on, and have a higher level of reliability than you would currently get from having your own Exchange server sitting in the office.
And I think also too, it sort of ties into, you know, the growth in the importance of technology in all businesses. So, you know, back when, in the day when I started, it was typically people with a standalone PC that, you know, just worked by themselves or maybe did a bit of print sharing. then to an environment where they had a local network, but it still wasn't that important. You know, I mean, it was important for them, but, you know, they could be down for a little while. And now it was then moving to a point where the systems were becoming absolutely critical because they're running point of sale, they're doing payroll. The small business had become, you know, as dependent on IT as a large enterprise. And then at that point, it's like, okay, well, you know, we need these things 24/7. We need more capacity. We need more disk space. We need, but again, we don't want to necessarily incur the significant costs of running up the infrastructure and, you know, the other challenges that came along with that. So it's sort of at that point that the, you know, the concept of utility computing that was mentioned back at the beginning there, where effectively, you know, IT has become a utility. It's required as much as electricity these days, has come to the fore. And in that sort of economics, the large providers are the ones who are generally going to dominate, like in, you know, shopping and Amazon and, you know, the big providers that can do that, yes, at scale and spread the costs are going to provide the benefit. Now, during that period, obviously, as we're moving through all of these different phases and you're moving along in your journey, you would have had experiences and interactions with, you know, the traditional partners out there. How have you seen their approach, especially their business approach to, you know, moving with the times and adjusting to this new model that, you know, customers are now effectively demanding a per month, per user cost?
Yeah, so when we first established, when that Microsoft business was first established within Telstra, a channel team was also developed to go out and recruit Microsoft partners who would want to sell under the Telstra umbrella. And you could see that those that sort of were, you know, you can call them visionaries or early adopters, you noticed that a lot of those guys really came on board. Those that really, probably the best way to describe it, is really embraced the relationship with Telstra, because Telstra was a really great sales engine. You know, a lot of salespeople, you know, touching a lot of businesses.
They had a lot of contacts in the marketplace for sure. Absolutely. Every business had some interaction with Telstra for sure.
With Telstra. And if they didn't, they had in the past. So there was always an acquisition strategy within Telstra to try and win customers back. So layering additional products and services was seen as a great way for Telstra to engage its customer base. And those partners, you know, and I still engage with some of those partners now at Ingram. These were partners that 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, joined the Telstra program and really got their start in 365 through that program. But it still surprises me a little that there are some MSPs that haven't really embraced it. And don't forget the exclusivity arrangement with Telstra, I think, ended in 2014, so nearly 8 years ago. So
why do you think there's that still that resistance? What, you know, is there a commonality? Is there a something that you can point to and say, well, the majority of people who are perhaps not, you know, moving on to this sort of new environment, what's holding them back, do you feel?
It's hard to say. It's a mix of reasons. There are some that have. One guy said to me, he's never forgiven Microsoft for that, for locking them out of 365 so many years ago. I don't think that's common. I think it's more likely the fact that in some cases there are certain industries, particularly things like manufacturing and. That have specific requirements that still require them to have sort of on-premise infrastructure. But I think that's getting less and less. And you saw that as more and more software providers move to the cloud. There is a specific application that is still on-premise based. So the excuse is, well, let's keep everything on-premise. Let's continue to host a data center on the customer side. Or a lot of partners in the early part of last decade really invested heavily in building their own data center infrastructure. So they've got a significant asset there, and they don't want to switch it off and suddenly send everything to Azure and to 365 when they've got it to a point where it's it's very profitable.
I think, and also, one of the other things that I think a lot of people probably don't appreciate is that, you know, time marches on for all of us. I've now got, super old technology when I first started out. And I think what we're seeing is we're getting, younger waves of people running businesses who've grown up, in the millennials, as they say, used to computers, used to IT, used to mobile devices, where, when I was a kid, none of that was available. But, people coming into the workforce and beginning to run businesses and come to significant influence inside businesses, this is now they're accepted. They just accept, fast internet, yeah, fast Wi-Fi, a good modern device. And I think that is also a major driver to, moving this way as well.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. Anyone that's grown up with this is, considers it. And you see it whenever a customer changes IT manager, you'll generally find it's somebody a little bit younger or more experienced with the technology, and therefore they make the change immediately, whereas somebody else may have held back because it's a major project. And, to do that transition is not easy. It's gotten easier over the years with migrations and whatnot, but it's still a major piece of work to do.
All right. So if we were to look at, in your experience and looking at the situation today and where you're placed, what would you say are some key factors for partners that are, doing it well? That, what are the characteristics that they exhibit above those who may still be hesitant or may not have, made this change and improve their profitability?
Well, look, the partners that are doing it really, really well are partners that have, in terms of their business strategy, probably have one thing that they're really, really good at. So there was a great book written in the 90s that Telstra adopted in the late 90s called The Value Discipline of Market Leaders. And it was a sort of a triangle that you had to be good in all areas. So, for example, you had to be very good at, customer intimacy, operational effectiveness, or product leadership. And Telstra realized that their opportunity was to really excel in customer intimacy. They couldn't influence product very much because their product was delivered by an Ericsson or an Alcatel or somebody else. Yes, they could have some influence on it. And telcos aren't traditionally operationally efficient necessarily. But you still had to be good in those two areas, but you had to excel in one. So when I look at the partners that do it really, really well, partners that have chosen one thing they're really good at and they still ensure that they're doing everything well across the board, but there is one area that they're really good at. So some partners engage customers in a particular way, or they have a unique commercial model that works for them, and they only choose customers, engage with customers if they're prepared to take that model. So it really varies, but I think it's those partners who just find the one thing that they are good at or want to be good at, and they engage the market in that way.
So I agree with you. I think that one of the key things that I try and speak to people about is the need to go deep rather than wide. I think having that really deep knowledge rather than spreading across multiple vendors, multiple products, is actually going to generate you more revenue because it's much easier to support. There's less vendors involved. There's less friction. Again, it's a business decision. I appreciate that. But if you really want to sell a lot of products, you're taking the Amazon or the supermarket approach. And that boils down a lot of cases to volume, selling lots and lots of commodity items, and you'll always be fighting on price. I think you want to look at the specialization, and you're right, you can do other things around it that support it, but you want to be really well known for something, and that's going to attract people to your organization. And then when they say, well, we see that you do this, but can you also do this for us, then it's like, yes, we can, or one of our partners or one of our connections can do that, and then the business continues to flow through you rather than through someone else. So I think I agree with you that that really is the focus to be successful is really to look at specialization and saying, look, you know, this fringe stuff that we've been tinkering around with and, you know, whatever it is, you know, we probably should give that away or partner with someone else and really go deep, you know, on these core products.
And complexity is the enemy. The more complex a system is, the more likely it is to collapse. I'm a bit of a history buff, and you talk about the fall of the Roman Empire, and more often than not, they tell you that it's about the complexity that led to its downfall. And so when you can partner with, say, a Microsoft who have a very comprehensive solution, it probably covers 90% of what your requirements are to help run a business. Then you can start to peel away at some of the other products and services that you probably sold before and sell a package. And it means, like you said, you've got, you know, less products to manage, less training, less things to be engaged with, so that you can provide you simplify your internal processes and solutions to be able to spend more time focusing on customer requirements and making sure your customers managed appropriately.
All right. So if you were going to give advice to maybe those partners who are on the cusp, who are, you know, sort of a foot in each camp at this stage, maybe a bit uncertain, moving slowly towards, you know, this modern approach to their offerings to customers, maybe don't feel comfortable with it, don't feel that they've got the right process, or, you know, there's just not quite something that gels in their mind, you know, what would you be recommending for them to, you know, take this leap and move in this direction to, you know, be more involved and hopefully, again, look at being more profitable in this modern environment?
Well, there's no doubt the first thing you've got to do is do it yourself. So do it on your own business first. It's not a difficult transition. You're already using these services, but in an on-premise fashion. Moving to the cloud is you're using the same products, it's just being delivered differently. So once you've got the ability to actually do it yourself, then on your own environment, it's easier then to move customers across to the same. You know, we're in a unique position now where this pandemic has sort of taken some cost out of a lot of businesses, and the requirement to go on site is becoming a lot less. So I do a lot of sort of work with partners to understand sort of their economics and how they've changed over the last couple of years. And if you look at pre-COVID, you know, wages sort of had a steady growth, yet, you know, sort of generally rising prices around energy and travel costs and whatnot. And those things have pretty much disappeared. And so the profitability for partners has improved dramatically. And if you can deliver your services through a remote environment, so a cloud-based service, then there's hardly any need for you to ever need to go out on site anymore. So I think partners, the cloud partners have probably seen an improvement in productivity just because we've changed the way we work. More and more of the services that we're providing the partners now through Microsoft are, you know, more remote enabled and being able to, you know, deliver a PC directly to an end user without having to go through the IT department. Providing, you know, management services, you know, like Lighthouse and Sentinel. These are services that enable partners to do their business more efficiently. But I think the other side of this more current world, as we move to more of a hybrid work, is that collaboration within organizations has also shifted as well. So the accidental bump into somebody and talking about a particular idea has disappeared. So finding ways to keep employees engaged in this environment, particularly as we're still all remote at the moment, in some states anyway, how do you maintain collaboration amongst your team?
I think a very good example of this is the recent announcement of Windows 365. So Windows 365 is basically a virtualized desktop sold as a service by Microsoft, built in, run in their Azure data centers. And the big change was it's now a a flat rate per user per month to get access to a dedicated VM that you can effectively, you know, log into and retains the state on any device. Now, when you step back and look at it in a bigger picture here, it's like, okay, this is now the first time in history that someone could deliver a complete network, including endpoints. So the user can just, you know, dumb terminal in effectively to a range of devices that have been managed, set up, or all maintained in the cloud by Microsoft without ever having to go and see and touch the client. And I think the other big point here is that, you know, that is obviously, you know, a significant inflection point. But the other thing to consider in all of this is the move away from hands-on infrastructure to configuration to a software-based configuration. So everything now is driven by scripts, is driven by automation. There is less and less of this hands-on stuff that has been moved into data centers that large providers do. So the thing that I see is that, you know, so, you know, Windows 365, much like BPOS back in the day, is an inflection point, right? And you have a huge opportunity. There is risk involved betting on the technology. I 100% agree, but you can minimize that. But if you're early to the game here, or you get in front of the pack here, you are going to generally be much more profitable. And I think that's what I'd be recommending people to look at. You know, what are these changes in technologies that we can jump on board early and be an early adopter and then lead the pack rather than trying to come up from the rear? So I think something like Windows 365 gives that potential at the moment. There's not a lot of people in the market. People are still hesitant. They all see it as new technology. They're all going to be conservative. And if you look at it as a pure business opportunity, you would say, you know what? I'm prepared to take the gamble or the risk here because I think this is going to be a big product. And to justify that, I think you've just got to look at the limitations when it comes to supplying components for devices. I mean, you can probably speak better to it than most, but, you know, these PCs people want on their desktops, the physical PCs, are proving hard to order. I mean, I'm still waiting to be able to buy my Xbox Series X. It's killing me, I'm telling you. You know, it's been a long time. So that's, you know, a problem that this sort of technology can solve and you can point to worldwide, and there is an opportunity for someone to jump out in early. So that's, I think that's
exactly
what I see. You do have to take a bit of a risk, but the returns there could be quite significant.
Well, imagine if we had Windows 365 18 months ago.
Oh, yeah.
This pandemic could have been handled so much better. We wouldn't have had some of the problems that we have now. So, but look, I think the other thing I'd mention too is that with every customer, a lot of partners think that they have to do this sort of big bang approach and transition their customers to the cloud. But, you know, there's always a pretext with each customer. Sometimes it's a security incident. Sometimes it's it's a renewal of some hardware. A lot of these things can be done gradually. And these were our early experiences as we, you know, transition partners and customers to the cloud that, you know, there was no need to scare them into it. No one was going to shut them off. But, you know, this was something that could be done at specific milestones. And you plan your way. If you've got, you know, 50 customers on premise still, you can plan your way out of that over time get to them before somebody else does, because somebody else will come in and make the offer to your client, and you don't want to be sort of left out.
I think and that's another interesting, again, change of dynamics, is you can now service customers that are miles away from as far as you could drive in a day. Yeah. Typically, most people could only look after customers they could drive to comfortably in a day. So that presents an opportunity, but it also presents a threat, because it means other people can also potentially, you know, service customers or have offerings in there. And I think one of the biggest challenges I see that, you know, customers, you know, when they dial into Microsoft 365, they see all these icons on that opening screen. And I'll guarantee you, they're sitting there thinking, you know, we've paid for all this. Why aren't we using all this, in the back of their minds? Yes, we get Exchange and we get emails, boring. But, you know, what are these other icons doing? And I think, you know, you can also now have a challenge with people inside the business who are willing to tinker, who aren't afraid of technology, who will read the articles, look at YouTube videos and work it out for themselves, rather than relying on somebody, you know, when they're ready, coming to them and you know, bringing it on board. So I think that's the other thing, that it's important to have that knowledge. And as you say, the important thing then is to make sure that you do have some idea about all of these sort of technologies, or have a contact that you can refer to that can say, look, if you want to talk about Power BI, we don't do it. That's not our specialty, but we have a contact or a referral we can bring in for you.
Oh, absolutely right. And we you know, we've done a lot of work in building programs where our partners can work with each other. So if somebody's got a Power BI expertise, you know, don't just be a modern workplace partner, or, you know, just don't isolate yourself to Azure. There are opportunities for you to cross-pollinate with other partners so that you can provide a complete service offering to your clients. And don't let the sort of technology scare you too much, because there are partners who are prepared to work, you know, in a sort of a closed service model with you to deliver that solution, where you can maintain the relationship with the client, but somebody else is delivering the service.
I think that comes back to that point of specializing. You know, you do need to have a general idea of it, but you need to go through that stack and say, right, you know, these are the things we want to and like doing, and these are the things that not so much, and we need to involve in a partner. And I think one of the changes that successful partners realize is, sort of back in the day, there was very much a lone gun approach to being an IT professional. It was you against the world. It was you against the machine. Mm. It was you against the customer and every other provider out there. I think the successful ones look at it and say, you know what, we're just going to do this component really well, and let others know, and then we'll bring partners on, and we'll look at being a big business but in a small way with lots of partners. So I think that's, again, another key change, that the people that are successful don't have that feeling of being threatened when, you know, other people from their peer group are probably more skilled or knowledgeable on some components.
Yeah, look, and there are some great stories from partners of how they've transitioned, but I can recall a story back in the late 90s when I was at Telstra, and we had a couple of guys coming around servicing our PCs, and Telstra was always notoriously late when it came to upgrading the operating system. And I think in the late 90s, we were still running, you know, Windows 95, and, you know, you'd get guys saying, oh, this is not what I really want to do, because this technology is 4 years old. And I think for partners who don't make that transition are going to find it difficult to find, you know, good people who are with the skills to work for you. So unless you're going to, you know, run your business sort of as a one-man band and, you know, do it until you drop, it's you know, you've got to make that transition. But it's a transition, it's not a revolution, it's an evolution. You can do this over time. You can pick the applications that you want to move first. It's not as scary as it seems. And, you know, the things that would have scared people before, like things like migration and downtime and things like that, all those issues are being resolved. So, you know, you can take advantage of the work that's been done over the last 10 or 15 years by other partners who've gone this way.
And I think that's the key. I think, you know, you just can't do it all anymore. We could back in the day when we had an on-prem SBS box, but it's pretty difficult to do that in the world of the cloud. And with so many things coming out, we've got, you know, things like Viva and all those sort of things, which are now taking it to another level just in collaboration alone. So again, I think the success there is partnering. And the other thing I think too, is looking at seeing your distributor and Microsoft as a partner. I still see a lot of antagonism to people with their distributor. They see that as a pure transactional arrangement rather than an opportunity to you know, provide and work together and align. And I tell people, look, you know, it's going to be a lot easier if you align yourself with, you know, what Microsoft's focusing on the moment and the way it's going, rather than trying to fight them. That's going to be a much more successful road, I would suggest.
In the end, a vendor like Microsoft will. To be fair, compared to others, I mean, I remember when I think it was Apple who got rid of the 3.5 mil headphone jack. You know, that was that was a massive thing. But a vendor like Apple will just make that happen because they're so product focused and product driven that they think it's the best thing for their product, and they bring people with them. Microsoft tends to do these things gradually, so, you know, it understands the impact that this will have on its customer base. So it doesn't make decisions lightly. It takes time, and they work with distributors like us to help the channel move along. But at some point, Microsoft's going to say, I'm not going to support, you know, Exchange on-premise anymore, or I'm not going to support some of the other products that we have because we are, you know, we're all in on our online services. So, you know, at some point, the vendor's going to make you do it. So, you know, get there before, you know, you're really left behind. And look, we're talking years away still, but I think it's important to provide the best deal for your partners and what's most profitable for you longer term.
Well, I think also too, you know, we say it could be a long term, but you look that, you know, as people like Microsoft say, they've had 2.5 years of, you know, digital transformation in a couple of months when the pandemic first went large. Yes. So again, you've got to prepare yourself for that. And I just think that that was an example where people who were balancing too much suddenly, you know, being loaded with that all of a sudden really caused some problems. So, and I think also too, the products themselves have got deeper as well, and they are continue to, you know, get deeper as Microsoft invests more and more in those That's products. True. So knowing them well is going to differentiate you from people who are just, like I said, doing just Exchange Online, providing mailboxes, and the customer looks at it in the morning and goes, meh, what happened? You know, I had email before, I've got email now, looks the same to me, a different color, and some other features, but meh, yeah, it's the same. So I think that's it. Yeah. All right, George, well, I think we have covered a good deal of information here that has provided people with lots of benefits. So to round off, what I might get you to do maybe is just give us a bit of a summary and a, you know, takeaway for people out there who are looking to, you know, what should I be doing next, or what should I be focusing on? And then if you wouldn't mind just providing some contact details, so if people do want to get in touch with you and follow up, they can do so.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll leave you with two short case studies from a couple of our partners. One where a partner decided that they were going to move all their customers to Business Premium, to Microsoft Business Premium, and if the customer wouldn't transition, that they would ask the customer to leave and find another provider. When they did that, almost all their customers transitioned because they sold them on the benefits. The increase in revenue more than accounted for the loss in the two customers that they had. So while that's an extreme example, we work a lot with partners to try and transition customers to higher levels of security. So that's probably the first one. The second was a partner who built a case study for one of their customers and published it broadly. One of the customer's competitors called them and asked them what they did and how they did it, and that customer then became a partner of that partner. So there are many ways that partners can enhance and improve their business. And it's not necessarily just about chasing new business, but it's about expanding the capability for their partners, for their customers, sorry, and, you know, providing them more and more services within the ecosystem that they've got. So that's probably the two takeaways I'd like to leave people with. If anybody wants to reach out to me, you can reach me on LinkedIn. It's George Farrah, F-A-R-A-H, or you could reach me at Ingram Micro at george.farrah@ingrammicro.com.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, I'll take this opportunity to thank George for his time and the insights that he has shared with everybody. He's probably getting to the same stage as I am to be considered a veteran in the industry, which is a bit of a worry, but anyway.
Thank you very much.
That's all right. It happens to the best of us. It does. We like to think that we're getting more senior, but also more knowledgeable. So that's the story I'm sticking with. So again, thank you very much for sharing that information. Please do get in contact with him if you do have any further questions. Remember that if you do have anybody that you'd like to have interviewed or have questions for on this podcast, please by all means also contact me. And I will take this opportunity, as always, to thank people for listening to this podcast. I know that George is an avid podcaster and also spreads the word, so I do appreciate that as well, George. So you're ticking all the right boxes.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, I'll thank you. I thank everybody for listening to this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Microsoft 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selections available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.